Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Orfila Center's Structural Violence, Police and Prison Abolition and Decoloniality Research Clusters podcast. Today, we are going to be talking to Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson has a PhD in political science from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he is a visiting lecturer at Seattle University. He has published articles on Friedrich Nietzsche, Martin Heidegger, Gilles Deleuze, Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault, David Graeber, and the global emergence of far-right authoritarian populism. He is working currently on a book manuscript addressing the historical formation and development of police institutions and how these histories are vital to, but also challenge, the contemporary abolition movement. Thank you so much, Andrew, for agreeing to share with us your knowledge today. I wanted to start off by asking you a question related to your work with the Orfila Center. We know that you recently taught a class about global policing and that the syllabus was in part inspired by the work that you did with the Orfila Center in collaboration with the MENA Prison Forum. Can you tell us about your experience teaching this class, how you chose the readings for it, and how your discussions with the students went?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here. Second of all, in our sort of work with the structural violence, police and prison abolition and decoloniality research structure, we created a set of bibliographies about global carcerality. And utilizing a teaching syllabus by the MENA Prison Forum, we added our own sort of bibliography information to a sort of revised syllabus. This was, in many respects, a really great project for me to just start visualizing what a class on global policing would look like. And so it was just really, really useful work. And it was also a really great resource, hopefully, for a new generation of scholars that hopefully will start teaching about the interconnections between police and prison systems all throughout the world. And so I was really, really happy for the work that we accomplished. And it was really amazing to have that as a basis to form a syllabus so that I could actually be teaching that up here in Seattle. And so let me say a couple of things about my global policing course. This was a sort of a course for the core curriculum here at Seattle University. And the students were from diverse majors. So they were not necessarily political science majors, but this was an elective course. But there was a requirement that the course would have some sort of a global dynamic theme. And so I proposed this course and kind of designed it and got it approved relatively originally. No one is really taught in this material before. Moreover, I sort of reached out to a lot of friends and colleagues throughout the academic wastelands to kind of get syllabi. And it's also really remarkable how this sort of course material is just not really being taught very much at all throughout the academy. And so it was really, really exciting to be able to kind of be creating a syllabus for material that I think is just pressing and new and still kind of being worked out a lot. And so I think one of the other things that really inspired me to teach this course was the oxymoron about global policing itself, because policing is kind of a form of like local governance, but now we're trying to come up with this sort of global way to think about it and to look at the global connections between these local political institutions. And there is a really important sort of story to be told about the global politics of police institutions, but it's oftentimes very difficult to see precisely because policing seems to be local, seems to be very based upon national domestic political issues, precisely because police are sort of internal security forces. They're meant to be responding to the sort of domestic security issues that are affecting each and every country. The other thing is there's been a remarkable sort of explosion of research in global policing recently. Within just the past 2 years, but I think also within maybe like 5-year horizon, there's just been an explosion of new books that have been published on this topic. And so it's just a really interesting development that has happened within the study of international relations and the study of global politics that really demands that we try to address these topics. My experience teaching this course was that I actually had to do a little bit more teaching than I had to do in my courses on police and politics. A lot of, you know, my students, they have such a wealth of information about policing here in the United States. However, trying to talk about global policing issues or the way in which the sort of policing problems of the United States are also connected to policing problems throughout the world required some collective learning. And so it was a really, really fun class, precisely because of our lack of prior knowledge and because it was a sort of collective learning space in which we were all kind of growing and exploring issues that were a little bit new and perhaps foreign to us. The other aspect of the course was that there's a historical focus, but there was also a global focus in which we kind of went on a global tour. In which we were analyzing the relationships of colonialism to policing, and then the development of Interpol and transnational police organizations and border policing. And so we kind of had a global tour. And also the students kind of had their moment to sort of teach the class about their particular country or their particular region. And so there was also a kind of a collaborative learning environment in which the students became the teachers.
I think that sounds like an amazing course. I would have loved to be in it.
We would have loved to have you. I assigned someone who was presenting on Egypt. I sent them some of your
journal
articles.
I really like the idea of thinking of policing at globally and thinking about how connected these systems are. So I know that you do research on political theory, international relations, and U.S. politics. I was curious about why you chose to tackle issues of structural violence, decoloniality, and policing from within the discipline of political science and through these lens. And I know that you are interdisciplinary and there's a lot of sociological aspects in your work, especially regarding social movements. So can you tell us a little bit about what it's like researching these themes from within this discipline?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, first of all, I kind of started as a philosopher and got a master's in philosophy and then taught philosophy for a couple years in China. And so when I came here to work in the political science department at UCSB, political science was sort of a new discipline, sort of disciplinary culture. And some of my sort of graduate career actually was actively learning about some of these norms or the sort of fields that were dominating the discipline. And so that was kind of like some of my like lived experience was kind of becoming a political scientist when I don't think I had been a political scientist before. And had just been kind of gravitating towards political issues and trying to think about, you know, my work from a theory angle. It was all political theory. I think the one thing that kind of like pushed me out of philosophy and into political science was just feeling that sort of questions from a theoretical angle or from within the study of philosophy were just too abstract. I just was alarmed by, you know, like real political issues. And I was really frustrated that the thinkers that I had kind of come of age thinking about and reading about oftentimes weren't really thinking about the same issues that I think we are struggling with, you know, like on the ground. And there's kind of a new sort of political terrain and political environment that I really felt like I had to kind of study politics to be able to inform, you know, my study of the sort of political theory canon. The other thing that I have to say is that political science as a discipline is just behind on some of these issues. Like, let's just talk about policing. You know, we're kind of undergoing a renaissance of, you know, police scholarship right now. But like, for a really, really long time, the study of police was not a political topic of study. That was relegated to criminology. And if anything, maybe it kind of slipped into sociology. And that, like, okay, sociologists were the ones who were studying policing. And political scientists just weren't. But nevertheless, like, policing has been a pressing political issue. The fact that it has been understudied, I think, is also really resonant in the way in which the issue has exploded, like, on the ground within actual political struggles. And it's caught a lot of elites, or maybe, let's say, some of the more privileged echelons of higher education a little off guard because they weren't focused upon these issues. But nevertheless, in the last 50 years, we've seen a bipartisan campaign on behalf of law and order policies that has created one of the most authoritarian policing and prison regimes currently, you know, on the globe. And I think that it also has really, there is a historical importance to this as well. And political scientists do need to study these topics. And the fact that they hadn't, I think, is also really resonant in the fact that social movements have been kind of ahead of the issue. And political scientists or scholars have been kind of lagging behind and have found themselves caught unaware, as if somehow the fact that the United States has 2 million people in prisons and leads most developed countries in the number of people killed by police was somehow not worthy of our interest or curiosity or scholarship. That's one thing. Now, the other thing is trying to think about global policing. International relations as a subfield also does not focus upon global policing. The issues that, you know, there is a sort of dominance of about economic issues, but security issues really kind of come down to issues of like great power conflict. There's an obsession with nuclear weapons. And the fact that the kind of creation of a sort of global policing network has been relatively ignored or understudied by international relations specialists, it is revealed through the way in which other types of studies have become the dominant paradigm, such as like the democratic peace theory. I mean, I think the democratic peace theory, at least if you, you know, listen to some of the dominant voices within the study of IR, completely ignores the way in which covert war or atrocities have kind of continued throughout the Cold War and into the era of globalization, largely through the creation of internal security forces. And because of this, I think that a lot of IR specialists see the world in kind of rose-colored glasses, and they have lost the ability to maybe sort of critique U.S.-American global supremacy, but also the way in which local political elites have also used security forces as a form of violence to maintain their own power, but also to control their populations. That has kind of spurred my study in this, and largely because people weren't studying these issues, and it felt like that there was a need for these issues to be raised. And to be raised quite dramatically within political science. And I've, you know, happy to have played like a small part in that moment. But I also think that it should be a bit of a reckoning within political science as a discipline. Political science as a discipline is oftentimes wants to think of itself as engaging in a type of neutral political analysis and also on behalf of policymakers. And because of this, I think that it's really diluted a lot of the scholarship that's come out because it has been a little subservient to power and it has pulled its punches and refused to sort of see the world as it is, largely because it is more interested in trying to kind of disguise the ideological framework that is grounding the discipline. And oftentimes that ideological framework has been kind of a support of American global power, but also, you know, a sort of insidious liberal authoritarianism. And so I really think that this is a moment that allows the discipline itself to ask itself hard questions. Why weren't we studying these issues? Because it's not like these issues just became important within the last couple of years. They were important for the last several decades, and social movements and kind of people on the ground were raising these issues, oftentimes without you know, the Academy listening to them. And I hope that this becomes a moment in which we can really try to challenge some of the internal norms, both like within the political science discipline, but also I think within higher education generally.
Thank you so much. These are very important points. And, you know, I got my BA in political science, and definitely at the time, I think there wasn't much of this present, at least in my own coursework and stuff. So I think it's amazing that there is this sort of scholarship coming up. And I agree with you that there should be more of it. And I think your global policing class is an example of this. My next question kind of relates to this response. I wanted to ask you about your research trajectory, which you already spoke a little bit about with studying philosophy, but maybe you can also tell us about your trajectory on a more personal level or outside of academia. Specifically, I'm thinking about your view on the intersections or divergences between academia and activism. Would you consider yourself a scholar activist? I know you've done some activism. How does your activist work kind of relate to your scholarship and vice versa?
Yeah, well, as you said, there's a couple of different questions in there. So let me try to and I'm horribly long-winded. So I provide a pre-apology to your listeners. But let me try to wander through some various thoughts here. You know, I think in one respect, let me just go ahead and say that my interest in policing issues kind of came out of actually interacting with the criminal injustice system as a young person. I was kicked out of school, I was criminalized, and spent some of my early life kind of in and out of jail on probation programs. And really felt that my life was being stolen from me, and I was really kind of facing a system that was broken in real ways. You know, I get this question a lot. What brings you to these topics? Why are you interested in policing? And you know, I find this question really heavy on my shoulders, both because it requires me to kind of use the most traumatic moments of my life as a sort of promotional opportunity, and that it's constantly being investigated and gatekeeped in real ways. And I think that has been a sort of challenging aspect for me to kind of be okay, how did I come to study these issues? But at the same point in time, I kind of want to also establish a little bit of personal boundaries, kind of separating myself as an individual from, you know, my scholarship. But I think that there's also really important dynamics to play on the issue of positionality from standpoint epistemology, from the importance of lived experience as a basis for who is allowed to talk about these issues. And so I also really appreciate the gravity and seriousness that has made it so that we're trying to figure out which voices to prioritize and listen to. And I think that has been really useful because there has been a dominance of sort of more privileged voices. And I would include my own voice in some of that. So a lot of this has also been a bit of a kind of existential struggle, where some of my work has come from a deep place of anger, a deep place from injustice, and just political rage has kind of been the kind of origin story about why I was interested in these topics, but also a place of real critical self-criticism or critical engagement to try to rethink a lot of my own structural positions on these questions, but set of privileges, but also the types of voices that I found myself taught from an early age and stuff. And so I think the other thing is my study of these has constantly been re-education on these very topics, as I've had to find out that actually these topics remain a little unknown to me, and I have to constantly be reworking them and re-studying them from different angles. So that's kind of one sort of reason why I sort of studied policing, but it's also one way in which it's been kind of a psychological struggle within myself to kind of situate this as also kind of a career, which now I am trying to get jobs or promote myself as a sort of expert on these topics. And that's been a very, very odd sort of struggle to deal with. So I think that, I talked a little bit about how I sort of started by studying philosophy. And I think that that's important in a couple of different ways. First of all, a lot of my work kind of comes out of like an innate curiosity. There's a lot of different ways to do academic work. And one of it is to kind of translate complicated issues and into sort of more simple analyses so that we can kind of understand the world a little bit better. But I've been really drawn towards the messiness or the complexity of issues. And most of the kind of questions that I'm interested in are ones in which I'm still confused about. And so I'm like drawn to questions that I just don't feel like I have the answers to. And it has also been kind of a moment of, you know, like, I don't think that that's like the best way to do academic work. And I've like found myself running into walls time and time again, largely because I'm interested in questions that perhaps they're like meant to be contradictory, but that just seem very, very hard to answer or to resolve some of the contradictions. The other thing is philosophy as a discipline. If we're going to criticize political science as a discipline, philosophy's like way worse, you know, like, it is a discipline in which white male voices have etched themselves in stone. You know, I think a lot of my sort of study of, you know, philosophy was really, really biased in some really fundamental ways. And when I published an article on Michel Foucault and his Secret History of the Police in 2014, and I had spent my master's degree kind of writing about French philosophers in the 1960s and their different ways of thinking about policing. Michel Foucault being one of them, but also Deleuze, also Derrida. You know, ultimately the question of policing was at the forefront of their mind. And they came out with some really interesting things to contribute to the conversation. But in doing so, when I published this article, at least in 2014, this was right at the moment in which Michael Brown was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri. And then Darren Wilson was not indicted. This was kind of the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement. And it really was kind of a shocking moment for me on a couple of different ways. One was how little my sort of work on like French philosophers in the 1960s really had to teach us about policing here in the United States in the very beginning of the 21st century. The second was that like my sort of academic background, where I had been taught Foucault and Derrida and Deleuze as like the most radical voices out there to think of through critical theory, was just structurally kind of blind to the fact that there was a Black radical tradition that had been engaging in these issues in really, really important ways, and that had constantly been kind of relegated to the back of the bus. But that also their analysis was more sort of hitting the issue on the head of the nail. So that was kind of a really like big moment for me in just like, okay, like the academic superstars that I had been taught, there was something fundamentally wrong, that these were the people, these were the voices that were being broadcast. And second, that what they had to say, while it might be really, really important, they weren't allowing us to really think through the truly pernicious and complicated ways in which American policing had developed, largely to target communities of color, particularly Black communities here in the United States. So some of that has kind of been, you know, my professional development on these issues. And, you know, I still find myself to be a student of the Black radical tradition and not an expert on these topics. And there's become a really big issue about, you know, that like, A, we need to be making sure that the Black radical tradition of one example, or let's say sort of the decolonial thought as another example, are finding ways into our work and that they're forming the basis of our research and theoretical analyses. But there's a real limit in which white scholars, such as myself, need to kind of have really humble, a sit of humility about addressing topics that are just not our own. And so, you know, so I think that that also kind of reflects some of the existential psychological issues that has really grounded my work, because, you know, my research has not just been about sort of trying to analyze things that I found myself confused about in the world. It's also been kind of rooted in my own confusions. And the fact that I have kind of like found the study of policing as a way to kind of interrogate myself in really fundamental ways that has been incredibly useful for me, but has also been a sort of process of struggle. So finally, on the question of activism, you know, I think that this is a really, really challenging issue for us in the academy, largely because, like, the scholar activist, you know, has kind of become a little bit of a trope, at least here in the United States. There's, you know, kind of like, oh, the critical theorist squads are like out there dominating the local democratic socialist meetups, and they're interested in these like really broad abstract issues, and ultimately it doesn't really help us in trying to reach, you know, like working class populations in trying to make the sort of struggles that we're facing really salient. There's also something kind of problematic about academics or scholars, or let's say maybe the intellectual to kind of come upon the scene and to try to like analyze social movements and to provide the truth about like political struggle that's like happening on the ground. And that's not it. It just continues. I think that there's, you know, there's a big conversation that's been happening whether academics have the capacity to be activists. Jasmine Nahr had a very famous article, you know, the past couple of years ago saying that the dangerous academic is becoming an extinct species like the dodo bird. And ultimately, I kind of find myself slightly in sympathy with some of these arguments, but also very upset by some of the implications of them. Jasmine Nahr's article happened at a time in which Stephen Salata had been kind of expunged and blacklisted from the academy. She targeted Gio Marr as a kind of particular example of someone who, you know, publicly makes themselves out to be a sort of activist on social media, but that, you know, is not that dangerous and is still a sort of foot soldier for various academic institutions. And Gio Marr has been sort of run out of academia as well and blacklisted. Now in the moment of the sort of George Floyd uprising, Joy James has kind of called out sort of academic abolitionists and saying that like academics need to not be sort of colonizing or dominating conversations about what abolitionism is or is not, largely because we think of ourselves as activists, but oftentimes this is, you know, more huffing and hawing than is actually conducive to the work that we're doing, and that we're compelled by different sets of incentives. We use our sort of radical work to kind of promote ourselves and to help get jobs, to try to apply to grants. And, you know, like ultimately I'm a poor academic, very struggling. I'm largely in debt, and I would indeed love a job. And if there's any listeners out there who'd like to give me a grant, I'd really love it. But at the same point in time, the argument hits home. And I think that there's some really important questions that we need to ask in higher education about the way in which we're sort of analyzing social movements as outside observers. And oftentimes we are inserting ourselves as the smart voices about social movements within social movements. And it's actually been a little bit to the hindrance of social movements themselves. Social movements kind of struggled with the fact that they've become overly academic. And there's been a sort of facing inward of social movements that has kind of hindered our ability to do the actual work of bringing more and more people into the struggle. And so I think that my interest in this topic was born out of rage. It's also become animated by a sense of solidarity, and that I have kind of continuously struggled to both think of my work as something that I'm trying to teach to public audiences as a form of political education, but I've also found myself getting involved in various struggles. One is the occupation in Palestine.
Thank you so much for, you know, your honest answer. And there's so much that I think so many of us who are doing research can relate. All these existential questions, the confusion, the anger, they're like difficult questions to deal with. And I definitely agree with you about the point of thinking about how we can learn from people rather than that, you know, we're from the outside just like analyzing or something, or that we're teaching or something. So my next question also kind of relates to academia and activism. I know that you are active in the COPS off-campus movement, particularly during the protests across the UC campuses that were demanding cost of living adjustments. Can you tell us more about this work and what your experiences had been?
I'll go ahead and say this in a couple of different ways. So first of all, I had been sort of very involved in various campus organizations that were already doing work. We were already doing sort of activist work within the campus community. You know, we had been staging protests of like Raytheon recruiters on campus at UCSB. We had been sort of staging protests in Isla Vista about policing. And so, you know, I've been kind of working with both undergrads and other grad students on a lot of these topics for years prior. And oftentimes we've been sort of doing it in sort of small numbers. And most of the time, you know, people were kind of ignoring us, or it certainly hadn't created the groundswell of popular campus support that the COLA movement had. But a lot of the organizations that I were a part of became sort of very big figures for within the COLA movement, all sort of underground scholars, student activist network, Food Not Bombs. I think there's like, you know, a couple of the sort of labor union organizations. You know, I had been sort of building relationships with these people, and we've been doing work for years. And we'd oftentimes been doing them without anyone really paying attention to us. And then all of a sudden, COLA happened, and there was, you know, 5,000 people marching through campus. And it was just an explosive moment. And, you know, in which it was like, okay, you know, we had been organizing in the wilderness for years, and then now all of a sudden the entire campus is exploding about these issues. I myself personally faced houselessness when I was a grad student. And so the idea that there is a whole lot of grad students who just can't meet their basic needs was something that I personally experienced, and something that made me incredibly angry. And so that was a big part about how I personally responded to the COLA movement. The cost of living adjustment that we were asking for is largely because it's impossible to live in cities such as Santa Barbara, Santa Cruz, San Francisco, Los Angeles, like pretty much most of the places in which the University of California has campuses, on a graduate student stipend or salary. And it's really, really frustrating because we're expected to do a lot of really difficult labor, but we're also kind of expected to play the pivot person in between our students and the faculty. And we're supposed to kind of be figures of authority. It really is sometimes hard to navigate those situations in which we're not even being paid enough money to be able to meet our like basic needs. And so the COLA movement was just really, really great. And the sort of students that started this at Santa Cruz, they just kind of like tapped into one of the sort of big structural issues that is sort of facing us here in California, but also I think within higher education generally. I think higher education is sort of facing a crisis over neoliberalism and the corporatization of the university, and the fact that it is increasingly relying upon a precarious labor pool that's easily exploitable. And I think it's a structural crisis on, you know, within the United States generally, but particularly within the West Coast in regards to the unaffordable cost of living, and that it's just simply becoming increasingly more difficult to be able to pay for something like housing, which is a basic need, and that the struggle of grad students is linked up to the fact that there's a mass houselessness crisis that is affecting the entire West Coast, in which the police are kind of being used as the sort of weapon to attack these populations and through a sort of through sweeps and the criminalization of houselessness. It's very much sort of an issue that's finding itself face to face with the repressive apparatus of the state. The other thing I guess I have to say about the COLA movement is a couple of different things. First of all, I really loved the militancy of this moment, precisely because there's becoming increasing drives to increase union membership here in the United States. We're seeing that with Amazon workers and Starbucks workers, and I think also with grad students. It was a struggle for grad students within the University of California to form a union. I know a lot of my fellow colleagues throughout higher education who have been struggling on trying to form unions in which their universities are fighting them and trying to prevent themselves from unionizing. So that's like one part. But the other part is that what good is a union if they're just going to co-sign a sort of bad contracts on behalf of management? And it's really important to kind of see within the COLA movement that this was a wildcat strike. It was in a sort of unauthorized form of labor activism. And it was, I think it was a sort of moral imperative, you know? Grads, I mean, how can a union co-sign these contracts when a significant population of our workers are living on the streets and unable to make our basic needs, in which we are being paid sort of starvation and poverty wages? It's not just important that we increase union membership. It's also important that we increase union militancy and that we see the union and we see union activity as a way to kind of actually fight and combat the sort of neoliberal structures that are really oppressing us and exploiting us. The second thing that I have to say about the COLA movement is that, you know, it was also such a moment of feeling like a political failure, of feeling defeated. And that was really weird because it also came at a moment in which it felt like I was so enlivened with the fact that all of a sudden we shut down campuses all throughout California, and that it seemed that we were winning for a second. We were winning the battle of ideas. The undergraduates were in support of us. A lot of the faculty that I knew that what we were fighting for was the right cause. And so it was just so beautiful. It was so beautiful. And it was just a moment of just pure ecstasy in which it just felt like everything was possible, that we really did have the ability to play a leading role in combating a higher education system that has been taken over by capitalist interests. And then COVID set in and there was the lockdown. And also, I think that the Bernie Sanders movement and being defeated by Biden on Super Tuesday, it just felt like all of a sudden the horizons of possibility snapped right shut. And it was a moment of disillusionment, of feeling like, you know, going from a moment in which things felt politically possible to now, I don't know if what's possible. Like, you know, there's very few gains and victories to be had within that time. And I think it was also a COVID and the lockdown was a moment in which it also really frayed the sense of community that I think is necessary to create a real sense of an organizing community, precisely because COLA had been sort of somewhat of a new and exciting moment. It was also forming new relationships that were still kind of new and which people were still interacting with each other without sort of deep relationships. And so when we were sort of forced into our private enclosures, it really affected our ability to get organizing done. And I think that it also really frayed some important community work that we needed to do, largely that we needed to have a sense of solidarity together so that we see our interest as shared.
Thank you so much. I think your point about political failures and the failures of social movements and the feelings of failure and navigating the kind of hope and despair, I think it's important to talk about. It's very real. It's very present in so many different movements. So on that different note, I wanted to ask you about some of the most inspiring works that you have come across during your writing process.
I'll mention some things that have been personally important for me. First of all, one of my advisors here at UCSB, William Robinson, his book Promoting Polyarchy was just a kind of earthquake moment. Bill Robinson now he's kind of writing about the sort of emergence of the far right global populist movements. He has a new book, Global Police State, and now he's writing about sort of global revolts or global democratic movements, and it's all about the sort of most pressing current events. And one of his first books, Promoting Polyarchy, was about sort of democratic promotion programs in the 1980s, and the sort of shift in U.S. foreign policy thinking away from supporting authoritarian dictators to sort of utilizing civil society networks to advance kind of capitalist agenda, and oftentimes through policing, through trying to co-opt and train and incorporate police forces. And that was just a groundbreaking study that has shifted my entire view of global politics and has really influenced my thinking about why global policing remains such an important political issue. Another book that has been really, really influential for me is Stuart Hall and his colleagues at the Birmingham Cultural Studies, the contemporary institution for cultural studies, I believe is what it was called. They wrote a book called Policing the Crisis back in 1978. And for me, I think that's like just become the book that I've been sort of using to analyze kind of the neoliberal turn, but also the way in which policing has played a big role in that. When we talk about neoliberalism, we think about it in terms of a kind of an economic ideology. And oftentimes we've ignored the way in which neoliberalism happened as hand in hand with a sort of law and order response to the social movements of the 1960s and 70s. And so what I find really interesting is Stuart Hall and his colleagues are analyzing policing in the UK and Britain, but it just seems so resonant to the issues that we face today in the United States, but also the kind of explosion of sort of the American police state that has happened, since the 1970s. And so I find that to be a really, really important book that kind of helps me think about policing in a way that I felt like Michel Foucault or Jacques Derrida just like never really gave us the tools to think about the sort of political crisis that we're facing right now, particularly the role of the police in that. And Stuart Hall's book, Policing the Crisis, has provided me some of those tools. And so for that, I'm really thankful. The third thing that I would encourage people to check out is that I've become really fascinated with the Office of Public Safety, which was a program that kind of started during the Eisenhower administration. And it was used by the United States to kind of create, train, fund police forces all throughout the world. And so there's a couple different people who've been sort of leading on this issue, and it's taught me a historical story I didn't know before, and so I've been fascinated by it. So Nicole Siegel, apologies, but Jeremy Kuromov, I hope I'm getting that close, and Stuart Schrader, they all kind of produced some books within the past 5 or so years on the Office of Public Safety and about U.S. foreign police assistance programs.
Thank you so much, Andrew. This is really helpful. My final question is there anything else that you would like to add that maybe I haven't asked you about? Anything else you'd like to share?
I guess that one of the things that I've been thinking about with my students in the global policing course and maybe is both that like these issues are not just historic questions, but that they're present. And I know that you and me, we sort of were doing work with the MENA Prison Forum. And one of the things that happened in our class is I taught a little bit about our work that we did together and the assassination of Lachman Slim. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, a year or so later, that still continues to be something that his assassination and his murder remains unsolved. Mm-hmm. And that these are pressing issues that that are happening right now. The demand increased attention, particularly by international observers. I would say the other thing is I had wanted to have some of my friends in Palestine also come and provide some sort of teaching to my students, but you know, the time difference made it really hard. But I would say that I've been really alarmed by what's happening right now in Palestine. There is a sort of forced displacement and expulsion of a huge swath of the South Hebron Hills. And I have friends who are currently there right now doing sort of transnational activism on behalf of our sort of Palestinian comrades. I guess like I am drawn to their struggle, but I wanted to end by trying to encourage more people to pay attention to this issue and to start raising alarms, because ultimately, the Nakba, the catastrophe, hasn't ended. It wasn't just a one-time event. As Patrick Wolf says, colonialism is a structure, not an event. And the forced expulsion and displacement of Palestinians is, I think, a human rights catastrophe, and that it's not too late for us to try to stop it. But right now, the Biden administration and Democrats, people who want to call themselves progressive and liberals, are happy to throw the Palestinians to the wolves. And I think that it's really, really alarming. The fact that the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress are willing to, and I think that as we're trying to kind of work through failure, disillusionment, defeat, at this political moment, I think one thing that is important for me is to also try to think globally, to keep trying to think about how we can create a global politics that does a better job of addressing these atrocities. And, you know, the Russia-Ukraine war has been really revealing, because, you know, it's kind of revealed that there is a bit of a anti-imperialism of idiots, in which, based upon the fact that the United States is perhaps the largest purveyor of global violence throughout the whole world, is something really important.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you for being so generous with, you know, everything that you've learned and with your experiences and difficult questions. I think this was very fruitful, and yeah, I really appreciate your willingness to speak.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you asking me, and it was really, really great to be here. And